session number 32299, reel 9.
Tom Leach, reel 9.
So I hadn't been in a frontline jet squadron, and I joined my first one, it was 810 squadron, with a chap called Sheepy Lamb, who was a wonderful CO. And I joined that one in October 1955. Now, Sheepy Lamb was a qualified Empire test pilot, etc. And amongst his, I'll just mention him briefly, because he's dead now. But he was the chap who used to fly the Navy had a rocket-powered aircraft. I don't know whether you've ever heard about that one at all, the Fleet Air Arm. He was at Boscombe Down one day with his boss there, and they were looking at this rocket-powered aircraft lining up to take off. And it accelerated along the runway, pulled up, and bang, straight in, and blew up. And the chap turned to Sheepy Lamb and said, and the boss said, "Well, Sheepy," he said, "that's a terrible thing." He said, "I must congratulate you on, you'll be the next pilot to see the termination of these tests." And so he did. He's the only guy who actually took them up and flew them. The idea was you put your rockets on, you zoomed up, and you spent a long time sort of with your rockets switched off, and then you put the you had to have almost make a dead stick landing. But I mean, so it's not much good in all honesty having an aircraft like that if it's going to be in an aircraft carrier. But there we are. At any rate, Sheepy Lamb was a splendid fellow. We were now flying Seahawk aircraft.
Can you tell me about the Seahawk as an aircraft?
Now, this was a beautiful little aircraft. It was the first. The Navy had self-designed, the first jet aircraft in the Navy were basically were the Attacker. That was the first one. Attacker had the Vickers Armstrong aircraft, and it had a few defects, and there were quite a few casualties in one way or another. The Seahawk was a different thing entirely. It was a beautiful aircraft, although it did have its trouble. A single-engined aircraft, and it was a delightful aircraft to fly. It was a very, very popular aircraft, and the Attackers were, well, there was trouble with the Attackers from the word go. So although one or two squadrons did keep going, they were soon phased out, and the Seahawk took over as the Navy's first prime jet fighter. And there we are. I'm not quite sure what I'm talking about now.
So you went with 810 squadron. This was
810 squadron, was it? Yeah. That's what I just said. That's right. Yeah. Well, I stayed with HMS in the 810 squadron, and we were attached to HMS Bulwark, and.
Is it the same round again as we talked about before, though, with an operational squadron in that kind of peacetime role?
That was the peacetime role, cruising around. We took Bulwark and Albion. That's right, we were in Albion, and we had Bulwark with us as well. And the two carriers went out to Hong Kong. And we operated as a two aircraft squadron. I'm the only person that I know of that's landed on the wrong aircraft carrier, because on one day we were operating in the Indian Ocean, and the admiral had always had the Albion, which is our carrier, on the left hand side, on the port side. And etc. But for some reason, he'd switched the ships round. I had a bit of an emergency, and I lined up to land what I thought was the right carrier. And it happened to be the last land on of the day. I came down and I landed. I was on bloody Bulwark, the wrong ship. And they big smiles all over their face. They said, "Oh, you better go down and have a rest. You know, go down to the wardroom. Have a gin or something like that." And whilst I landed on the wrong ship, And I went up the following morning, having woken up, and when I got to my aircraft, the buggers had painted all sorts of rude remarks all over it. And I had, when I got back to my own thing, the commander said, "What the hell did you do that for?" And I said, "Well, I was concentrating on this, that, and the other." But everybody, they should have noticed that all their aircraft had landed on, in any case, and fired off a flag to me, because it was only something relatively minor. But I couldn't complete my normal mission. But there we are. But so I had to buy the wings, a bottle of champagne or some damn thing, or a gin tonic or something or other, and that was it.
And a nice aircraft to fly, the Seahawk.
The Seahawk,
a nice aircraft to fly.
Beautiful to fly. It was the equivalent of flying almost like a Spitfire. You know, the Spitfire was a beautiful aircraft to fly, and the Seahawk was a beautiful aircraft to fly. I flew it right through until we got onto swept wing aircraft in the scimitars. It was there's a picture of the Seahawk there. And there's Sheepy Lamb. This fellow, Jock McCannis, is still alive. And this fellow, is retired now. He was a British Airways pilot. And that's me there. The girl now. I don't know what happened to Hazel. I think she died or something or other. At any rate,
So you were out on Albion for that period of time, were you?
For that period of time, yes. And amongst other things, we were told to do a reconnaissance of some islands nobody had ever heard of, called the Maldive Islands. And they made it a photographic competition between the jets, the Seahawk squadrons, who we could fit cameras to our aircraft. And so this one day, we were sailing by the Albion and the Bulwark, and we... and we were told to do this, and we took off and we hit this blinking island. It was just like an invasion, because we zoomed down the coast and people were jumping in the sea. We'd never seen an aeroplane since the Second World War, and you could still see the remains of the old runway, all overgrown by trees in the area there. But we just, nobody told us. We just had, it was just a tropical island. And we zoomed flat-hatted across the beaches. And now, of course, it's a lovely place. It's called Garn, they built the thing. And in actual fact, my wife, as part and parcel of her stories, is the fact that she was an expert in traveling on Royal Fleet auxiliary carrier ships like Tide Reach, all the oilers and that sort of thing, and she's been on a number of those. It was open to anybody, but she followed it up, and she was one time went to Garn, and she said to the captain, "Can we sort of go ashore?" "No, it's not allowed," he said. And just at that time, the Royal Air Force chap in charge of Garn came up on board, and he recognised Deirdre, because I'd just had my squadron in Malaya, and she said, "Is any chance of you?" He said to her, "Any chance of you girls coming ashore, you know, brighten up our evening, you'll have a good time of going on a beach picnic and all the rest of it." And she said, "Oh, yes, please, you know, if it could." And at any rate, to cut a long story short, it happened she knew this guy, because he'd been at our house, as I've just said. And so she went along to the captain and said, "Well, I know this man, he's a friend of my husband's. And I'm sure it'll be all right if you give permission." So he reluctantly gave permission. So she was one of the few women, civilians, who had ever been to Garn before any tourist even got there. Because it was, as you know, it was restricted. There was only one ancient old woman who was allowed to, I think something to do with social work or something, rather, amongst the Royal Air Force. So something like that on that island for a long time. Then it was taken over as a holiday resort. At any rate, that's what we did, and that was. But the other thing I did there was to. We used to do a lot of when we were back in Britain. We used to do a lot of aerobatics. The Sea Fury was a lovely aeroplane for aerobatics and formation aerobatics. And it was whilst I was with this one, and one the only thing I've we used to spend a lot of weekends going around giving air displays all over the place. Not so much in 810 Squadron, but one time we were doing a Navy day in Rosyth. And I remember the final of the our display was what we called a downward bomb burst, where we'd all go up, the four of us go up right over the top, then we'd all split up, and we'd all pull out, and disappear away, and it just so happened that my right ahead of me was the fourth road bridge. There wasn't a railway bridge. There wasn't a road bridge in those days. And so I managed to go. I thought, Christ, should I go over or under? And there were no ships in the way. And so I went under the bloody fourth road bridge. To my knowledge, it's the only time anybody's been in there with an aircraft like that. Of course, you can't do it now because the road bridge is there and it's blocking the way.
In 810, did you do any operational work at all?
Any
operations with 810?
No. Well, we did actually drop a few bombs in Malaya because we were asked to. There's a chap called Chin Pen. Chin Pen was operating, and we were then. But they said, "Well, just tickle him up and drop a few bombs in this area." So they gave us an area of jungle. There wasn't any specific target. We were told to go and drop our bombs there, which is what we did.
And when did you leave 810 Squadron?
An 810 Squadron. Oh, I have to check this. We left 810 Squadron. I was with them for quite a long time.
Were you involved in the Suez operation at all?
In the which one?
In Suez.
No, I didn't. No, I couldn't be involved. I couldn't be there because I was doing something else at the time. Where the devil are we? We're still in. Oh, that's right, they're gone. I went from 810 Squadron to 738 Squadron, which was the commander Leahy, who lives just down the way here. And Spibley, he is a great guy. He's getting on a bit now, but in fact, he's coming up to have dinner with me next week, I think it is. It's coming Saturday. I was his senior pilot. And again, we were selected. Oh, our job there was to teach the students, the new pilots coming through, how to operate in the operational role, bombing, rocketing, etc. We spent most of our time going around doing dummy dives on Tain Range up in the Murray Firth and that sort of thing. We were nominated as the Naval Air Display Team in 1957. I mentioned that to you, haven't I? And 1957. And we thought this was the time when the RAF had huge Hunter aircraft. We had the Seahawks. And the RAF were also taking part in this biannual Farnborough Air Show, international show. And this was the peak of the period as well. And we thought, what can we do to show the Navy up in a good thing, in a good light, when the RAF have got all these lovely aircraft? And there's no doubt about it. It was a treat to see them because they had these 21 plane aircraft looping. It was absolutely lovely. But at any rate, they couldn't do it better than us because we painted our aircraft red, and we formed our own aerobatic team. We were the Naval Display Team in 1957. We also developed the trailing smoke that came on. Because previously people had used a little sort of a smoke canister to make smoke to show the trail, but we actually put oil in one of the reserve tanks in the Seahawk and fed the oil around to a little jet. The engineers did a local modification into the jet pipe. So when the leader said make smoke now, we all pressed our gun firing button. Not to fire bullets, but to open up the tap, actually, and the pump immediately sprayed oil into the jet pipe, which immediately sort of left this white smoke out and as a trail, and it would stop immediately, so we could switch it on and off at the correct time. First in the world. And we had Royal Navy painted in white paint on the underside of the wings, and the thing were pillarbox red. No other team in the world had ever done anything like that at all before. And I'll say that we were there before the Red Arrows. But I must admit that the Red Arrows are a superb team. I'll say that for them, and I've got nothing but they did. We were the first. I think I've shown you that photograph in the hanging up there, yeah. So that was that. Now, from there, I was selected to go as the air warfare instructor to the Navy's first supersonic aircraft, which was the Scimitar. And
so you'd been with them through 56 and 57.
I was there. I'm just trying to find out when I left them. Oh, there's the squadron there. There's the CO, and there's, I think that's me behind there or something. Or that's Spivlihi, and no, that must be me there. And there's the Seahawks, and there's all of them. That was up at Lossiemouth in Scotland. It was a lovely time. Come on, I got this in for you. Didn't it?
Is that right?
Yeah. Righto, 95th Avenue. Okay. Now, I finished as the senior pilot of 738 Squadron, and I was selected to join the experimental squadron, 700 X-Flight, for the introduction of the Scimitar twin-engined supersonic aircraft, which is about to be introduced into the Navy. We had six pilots who were from different walks of life. All of them except myself had some sort of swept wing experience in jets, and mostly in hunters and things like that, etc. But I had none at all. I'd only flown the Seahawk. It was the fastest aircraft I'd ever flown, and I had my first. I was briefed by Tom Innes, who was unfortunately killed in a motor car accident later on as the X-Flight, in October 1957. And I was the Scimitar is a big aircraft, two Avon engines, and it can cruise for a very long time at Mach 9 or Mach 9.7 or whatever it is, basically subsonic, but with a little bit of pressure, you could dive down and you could carry out a supersonic attack on another aircraft at altitude. But I'm jumping a lot of stages here.
Can I just ask with that, Tom, was it actually devised as a fighter?
Yeah, it was. It was a development by Vickers of the original attacker aircraft. It looks a bit like an advanced attacker, but it's a much bigger and it's a much heavier one. For a supersonic aircraft, it still had rivets which stuck out of the wings. It gave little small rivets, not huge ones, but little small ones. And of course, on a supersonic aircraft, you can't really have this. But it was the first effort by Vickers Armstrong, and the test pilot was a fellow called Mike Lithgow, lovely, lovely man, and whatnot. And we used to keep a close liaison with Vickers Armstrong, obviously, because everything we were doing was checking that their reports on the aircraft were accurate, and it was acceptable to go into the naval service, and also to develop the aircraft, because this was something that the Navy, something like this, the Navy, it was absolutely brand new in the Navy, and we had to devise methods of attack to make sure that using the weapons that we had available, we'd be able to deliver them at totally different speeds and whatnot. And so I had an assistant who came with me, who did better than me in the Navy, and a fellow called Middleton, Lynn Middleton, who I've already mentioned to you, who was a South African, who was on that AWI's course, who ended up as the captain of Hermes in the Falklands business, and was a retired rear admiral. He and I spent all our time doing these dummy dives and making notes of speeds and release speeds and accuracies and all the rest of it. And the rest of the time, we were just checking the aircraft out, taking how long it took from zero on the runway to opening the power and cruising up and hitting 40,000 feet. And all these things, we had a schoolmaster as well who took all the things down, and all these reports were all taken back to the naval headquarters and the people who were interested in this thing. So we did that for a long time.
So you were establishing really the parameters which that aircraft could operate.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. We were. That's what the brief was, to make an operational parameter for the aircraft and to check that it was safe and etc.
And from that, then it would be established for other pilots what it could operate within.
Well, yeah, everything from, on the one hand, we had to have, because of the speeds we were going to be travelling at. I mean, it was nothing for us to be going at 600 knots at the low level, or 650 knots. I'm out at the earliest place. My job was to make a big row with the aircraft and whatnot, because you'd see this thing coming in. You couldn't hear it, and you'd suddenly go woof. I'd only about the height of that telegraph pole, just above your heads. But again, I'm jumping. But we advised on, for deck landings, for instance, we advised on the procedures, because of the danger of bailing out of the aircraft at supersonic speed, you had to have your legs tied together. Now, because to save your legs being thing, and your legs would fail around and whatnot if you had to do it. And then you obviously don't want to land on an aircraft carrier if your legs are attached to the aircraft in the straps. So the very first thing you do is undo the straps there and make sure you can get out. But unfortunately, the people who took over in the first squadron, the commanding officer of the first squadron, a proper squadron, to take over and embark in one of the ships, I think it was a Victorious, actually, he failed to, that's one reason he was killed, actually, on the first deck landing. It received a big publicity in the paper, and he had failed to disconnect his garters, which is unfortunate. He was a very nice fellow, but on the other hand, you know, so there it is.
And there's a lot to concentrate
that
on.
That was just one thing. But we also had to do all these things. We had to find out how much fuel was going to be used. We did all the air-to-air refueling trials and all this stuff, just to back up what Vickers Armstrong had said. We were eventually taken. There's a lot of other people who said they were X-Flight, who were, because they were part of X-Flight, but these were people who were brought in order to form the first squadron. So we had our own little X-Flight all together for some months before we had to take these other people and train them up. Anyway, that was that. And a super aircraft. And there's the cimeter there. Very good.
So you did that all the way through 57 and 58?
Well, here we are, 57, 58, Tangmere, dummy dives, 15 and 30 degree, radar ranging, aerobatics, letdowns, gun firing.
So really everything
to do with the aircraft had to be tested out, and we had to put our seal of approval on it, and it was all okayed.
And what was your opinion of it as an aircraft? You've mentioned a little bit about it, but what did you think of it while you were testing it?
Well, I've written that down in actual fact in this book here, but I'll just share with this one here, not this one.
Just a second there, Tom. You were saying?
When I sat in that aircraft, and I'd done doing my first takeoff, and I'm taking off from Ford, which is now an open prison, I might say, the Tom Ennis, who was the commanding officer, who was the chap I mentioned who had been unfortunately killed in a road accident later on, he stood up on the wing and he gave me a final briefing and whatnot, and made sure I was all okay and whatnot. And he said, right, you're on your own. And there we are. So I looked at the blinking thing. I looked, at least you could see where the runway is, opened up the taps, and was immediately hit in the backside by the biggest force I'd ever felt in this world. Went roaring down the runway, and in no time at all, I was doing about 250 knots and accelerating like crazy. I'd never felt it. I'd never been in a swept-wing aircraft before. I'd only flown the Seahawk. At any rate, I was very careful, followed all the rules, and did a few gentle things, and gradually got used to it. I found the aircraft was a lovely aircraft. It was absolutely great. It had two engines, so it was reliable. It was nice to have, if you're flying from an aircraft carrier and out of the sea, it's nice to have the twin engine, and you could have enough power to actually do single-engine landings on the ship. If in the event of an emergency, easily, and it was really and truly, and we were lucky in the Navy at that time because it was the RAF had got the, they were just introducing the Lightning, but we already had this aircraft as an operational aircraft, and very few fleets, even the Americans didn't have one because we could go up, we went up to some American aircraft carriers, we were all operating in the Far East at one time, and they only had things like Crusaders and things, which were much, much slower than our aircraft.
So did he feel very much at the cutting edge?
Were at the cutting edge, as far as that's concerned, yes, that's right, yeah. Because it did have nuclear capability, and, part of the deal was to be part of the nuclear shield, if necessary, in the Cold War that was going on in those days. We could drop bombs and rockets and bullpups. The more advanced modern weapons are coming in now. Sidewinder and things like that we could carry. So this was the aircraft. And I liked it. I never had any trouble with it at all. And I thought it was an absolutely great aircraft. I flew it for, I don't know how many hours. It was quite a few hundred one way and the other.
So after the experimental work, what was the next stage for you?
Next stage for me was to go to sea. I mentioned I'd been in the destroyer earlier on. But I'd spent about 7 years again in the front line. There was no office job for me. I needed a rest. So I was sent to the Home Fleet flagship, HMS Tyne at Portsmouth, as the mate of the upper deck, which is a real old Navy expression, but basically speaking, the appearance of the ship and everything to do with the upper deck, the anchors and the things, came under my control. Actually, I was responsible to the commander, who was responsible to the captain of the ship. But we were the Home Fleet flagship for a while, and the only thing we did there were two things. We first of all smartened the ship up in Portsmouth, and to check everything worked all right, we went on a short cruise down to Torquay, down the coast here. And would you believe, the signaller, when we got out to sea, the signaller came along with a smirk on his face and said, "Oh, sir, I've got a little message for you." And I opened it up and it read, "Good luck, darling. Have a lovely cruise, Mummy." My mother has sent me a bloody signal. Ah, well, she's dead now. She had, I think they all appreciated the joke. I didn't so much.
Okay. But